Hello, and thanks for turning on the Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. I'm Bruce Jacobs, a producer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. In this episode, the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan gives RFERL an exclusive exit interview as he prepares to leave his post.
Have there been differences of opinion, differences of views about what policies should we adopt in order to achieve our common goals? Sure, there have been.
Ambassador Carl Eikenberry describing his much-publicized disagreements with Afghanistan's president.
Yes, I come in. Yes, just because you what? Arkhangelsk.
An Uzbek comedian is no laughing matter in his native country. We talked to him about why he was blacklisted there. And in our Uncovered segment, a look at government censorship in Central Asia.
They had to close down the entire blog platform instead of just taking out these two or preventing these two from publishing.
We begin with the big news story of the week, the assassination of the head of Kandahar's provincial council, Ahmad Wali Karzai, the half-brother of Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Ahmad Wali Karzai was a controversial figure, an alleged drug kingpin, and also said to have been on the CIA payroll. A lot of questions swirled around the man during his life, many without good answers. But one thing is certain, he was a powerful and important player in Afghanistan. I'm joined now by Akbar Ayazi, an associate director of RFERL, who once ran and now oversees the company's Afghan service. Akbar, what impact will the death of Ahmad Wali Karzai have on the politics of southern Afghanistan?
I think it's going to have an important impact because from what we know, that he was a main contact point for the president and the government with the Taliban, especially in the southern part of the country. So by him not being in the scene anymore, it's going to bring some kind of complications now, or maybe even the process may have to restart with the Taliban. But what other impact it's going to have is we're going to look at to, even though the Taliban have confirmed that they have killed him, but we still don't know. If it's a political assassination and it is done by the Taliban and those who oppose in the Taliban sector, which is the Haqqani group, opposed the negotiations and talks and peace, then things are going to get really complicated. But if it's assassination that is related to maybe family feud, maybe to one of these issues that you just mentioned in your intro, any business deals, drug deals, or whatever it is, we don't know, then it's going to be an issue that's going to be dealt with in that city, in the family, and in the circle. But in general, there's going to be a big implication of and for the peace process, and I think it's going to make it more complicated.
Now, given his allegations that he was involved in the heroin trade, that he was involved in perhaps working for the CIA, do you think that he was a force for positive change in Afghanistan, or was he more of a negative factor?
I personally believe he was a positive force because, southern Afghanistan, especially Kandahar, it's a region where it's very difficult to control it. Even though last year the international forces conducted major operations, but him being in power and also being in control of the region was a very positive role. He kept the balance of power because it's a very complicated tribal area, Kandahar, and he represented a major big tribe. So being the leader of a big tribe helped to keep the balance between other tribes.
Now, his brother, Shah Wali Karzai, was named to replace him by Hamid Karzai, the president. Now, he's not been known as a big political player up to this point. From what I'd seen, he mostly ran a successful housing development. What do you think about him filling his brother's shoes?
Quite honestly, I don't think he will. Because Ahmad Wali and his brother both, they spend most of their youth in the United States. They lived in there, they were educated there, and to my surprise, even Ahmad Wali surprised me when he moved after 2001 back to Afghanistan and established himself as in a powerful person he was now. I knew them from a very young age. Brother is also, you know, he grew up and he spent most of his time in the United States. I'm surprised that, or I will be probably more surprised to see how he adapts to the way in life of the complicated tribal system, and especially to put him as a chief of the tribe in a young age as he is. I am not quite really optimistic that he would fill the shoes of Ahmad Wali Karzai.
Akbar Yazi, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
The outgoing U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, is a relative newcomer to the world of diplomacy. Before becoming ambassador, he served in the U.S. military for more than 3 decades, and as a lieutenant general was the top commander in Afghanistan before he retired. Eikenberry sat down for an exclusive interview with RFERL's Kabul bureau chief, Rahimullah Samandar, in the Afghan capital. They talked about the transition of military control to Afghan forces, Iranian support for the Taliban, and his publicized differences with Afghan President Hamid Karzai.
What do you think about the future situation of Afghanistan, looking at the situation currently?
I think that the plan that's been agreed to by the government of Afghanistan, the United States, and NATO ISAF for security transition to be completed by 2014 is a sound plan. It's an achievable plan. That plan, when realized, will then have Afghan army and police responsible for security throughout the country. In other words, the government of Afghanistan will have sovereign control of its own security and the protection of its people. In order to achieve this goal, which is ambitious, certain things must be done. We have to have a continued steady increase in the quality and the quantity of the Afghan National Army and Police in order to replace the NATO ISAF forces that are still serving in your country. But I think it's a realistic plan, and as I said, I think it's achievable. What we anticipate, as long as that we're welcome here, that we'll be for many more years having our military forces providing training assistance, assistance in equipping your forces, providing certain capabilities that your forces may lack for years into the future, and we also would anticipate that your forces and ours will serve together in conducting counter-terrorist operations against our common international terrorist enemies.
So there are many concerns among Afghan citizens that the current security forces, especially the army and police, they are made of former militias, especially the jihadi groups, former communist militia, some of Taliban militia. So there is a concern after the 14. They will be, in a way, divided back to the militia groups. And you know, these jihadi groups are controlling everything around Karzai. So do you have any arrangement for that kind of concern in the future after?
Of course, the questions of then the unity of the security forces as you go into the future is one that I know is of concern to the Afghan people. My own view is, though, having first come to your country in 2002 as a major general with the mission of helping Afghanistan to establish its new Afghan army and being involved even those early days with the police, as I look at the caliber of your forces and I look at the leadership of the institutions, it's strong. Now, it's clear that at the end of the day, the army and the police of any country, they respond to the political leadership. So behind the army and the police, political unity, political coherence, political will is needed to control the army and the police.
One thing, sir, you know better that in the political structure, there are a lot of problems. There are oppositions, there are inside, even the two vice presidents are not very agree with the president. The same is the minister, the same is the parliament and other powers. So, and also in the meantime, Afghans are concerned. There is no strong common definition of enemies. So if this is the structure of political behind the army, and they have no clear definition for enemies. Some say Taliban are enemies, some say not. So how then they will fight against terrorism in Afghanistan or Taliban or any other groups?
Having served in your country many years, I still am confident that what unites all Afghans is a sense of nationalism. Also an awareness of the price that Afghanistan will pay should they lose the support of the international community, and the loss of support might come then with disunity. It's also important in the coming years that more effort is put into the building of political institutions and government institutions by the leaders of Afghanistan.
What do you prefer for the upcoming ambassador, how he can work smoothly with President Hamid Karzai? And can you see? Can you tell us what were the main reasons of these recent tensions and problems between you and President?
Even from the time I first came here in 2002, have there been differences of opinion, differences of views about what policies should we adopt in order to achieve our common goals? Sure, there have been. There's been moments of frustration, I know, for President Karzai. There's been moments of frustration for the United States of America. This is never going to be easy work. We have to have a relationship where we can be behind closed doors candid with each other. But when the door opens up, we also have to have a relationship where we reassure our people. Even with our differences, we still are fighting hard to get to those common goals and objectives.
So you have a long understanding and long experience. There is a sense among Afghans that the American government and the Afghan government were not able in the past 10, 11 years to share their common interest, common views on politics, on presence of NATO forces, and on many different issues, on interest of both countries. They were not able to talk very friendly, very frankly.
We're going to continue, as we go forward over the next several years, to have difficult discussions between the government of Afghanistan and the government of the United States. There's no way to avoid that. The Afghan people, they increasingly want sovereignty. They want their government, their security forces to be in charge. We wish to do that as well. Trying to achieve that, though, the pace that we do this at, the exact agreements that we reach, say, for the conduct of our own military forces in your country, that will lead to differences. Those will lead to tough talks. There's nothing wrong with having tough talks between good friends. We're going to continue to have those.
So one concern is about Iran and Iranian interference in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And the UK Army, US Army have many, many evidence for that.
We do, yeah.
But there was no pressure on Iran. The Afghan government keep their relation with Iranian government. Even they listen to the Iranian speeches talking against our allies in the country. Never Afghan government give comments on this. So what will be your allies strategy in the future if Iran keep this kind of support to the Sunni extremism, although they don't like it?
Iran is providing a degree of support for some elements of the Taliban. This is absolutely clear. It's up to your government to make its own decisions, of course, on what kind of diplomacy, what kind of relations does it wish to have with all of your neighbors. We believe that the United States of America, first and foremost, remains a very good friend of Afghanistan, and what's important to us is that we have a good bilateral relationship with Kabul.
Thank you very much, sir, for your time.
Okay.
Радіо Фердо по шома.
Радіо Свобода. А за тим ГТМ.
Now it's time for our regular segment we call Uncovered. This is where we discuss some of the best original reporting coming out of RFERL's 20 local bureaus, stories that are often underreported or uncovered by the Western media. This week I'm talking with our editor Pete Baumgartner in Prague. First up, there's the story of two Uzbek journalists on a hunger strike to protest government censorship. Our Uzbek service reported dramatic developments there. Pete, what do you tell us?
Yes, one of the two journalists, Saudat Omanova, was taken to the hospital 2 days ago, and she had to stop her hunger strike because of that. She's apparently in serious condition. And meanwhile, the second hunger striker, Malohat Eskankulova, she continues with her hunger strike. They've been on hunger strike now for 16 days, at least when she was hospitalized. It was the 16th day. It's now gone on to the 18th and 19th day for the second journalist. And it's really a critical stage because it's a serious hunger strike where they're just taking water.
And what do they hope to achieve with the hunger strike?
They're protesting censorship in the media. And both of these women were journalists working for a youth TV station, a state-run TV station. And they both fired in December when they protested against censorship. And so they started a hunger strike outside the president's residence about 2 weeks ago. And they were both arrested and fined. And so now they decided to continue the hunger strike in one of their homes where they couldn't be arrested. And that's the current situation.
All right. Well, also from our censorship file, all WordPress blogs in Kazakhstan have been blocked for weeks now. What's happening there?
Yeah, there's a blog platform in Kazakhstan called WordPress, and it has about 500 Kazakh language bloggers on it. And it's been blocked since June. And people now, many of the bloggers there are saying that, you know, they're tired of this and it's illegal and the government needs to allow them to continue blogging.
Well, what sparked the blockage?
Well, the government is saying that there are two illegal blogs on WordPress, the blog platform. And they said because they continued posting unlawful information, they had to close down the entire blog platform instead of just taking out these two or preventing these two from publishing.
But do we know what it was that was illegal about even those two?
No word on that at all. No, they listed them, but they didn't say what it was that they did that was so illegal. And there's a little bit of a history here because in the past, Kazakhstan has shut down many different websites and has also banned and blocked both livejournal.com and blogger.com.
Okay, and finally, we also heard that an Iranian actress and blogger has disappeared in Iran. What do you know about that?
Yes, a blogger by the name of Pega Hanagarani was arrested in Tehran, we think about 10 days ago. We have no word on her, and neither do her relatives. She was supposed to fly to Germany to cover the 2011 Women's World Cup. And she was going to work for Deutsche Welle while there, and she never arrived, and no one knows exactly where she is. And she's actually now the second young female sports journalist from Iran to be arrested or detained who was supposed to go to Germany to cover the World Cup.
Do we know why the Iranian government doesn't want her to go abroad? Or
there's no information about why she was detained, why either of these women were detained, or what might be the possible reason. The relatives have heard nothing. It's all very mysterious, although it could possibly be related to the fact that FIFA put a ban on the Iranian women's soccer team from wearing the hijab while they play, and that caused actually great outrage in the Iranian government when that came through. So perhaps it's a way of getting back at FIFA in some strange, unusual way.
Well, I guess with a lot of these censorship stories, there's a lot of unanswered questions, but we'll keep looking into it. So, Pete, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. Uzbek comedian Obid Asomov is a household name in the former Soviet states due to his role in the popular Russian satirical serial Distorted Mirror. But the comedian is essentially blacklisted in his native Uzbekistan, and Asomov suspects it might have something to do with his comedic depictions of illegal Uzbek migrants and their hardships in Russia. RFERL correspondent Farangiz Najibullah narrates this report she worked on together with Sadreddin Ashur.
He might be considered the most famous Uzbek in the former Soviet Union, but comedian Obid Asomov has been made virtually invisible in his native Uzbekistan.
Встречайте, заслуженный артист Узбекистана Обид Асомов.
Despite his success on a popular Russian serial viewed throughout the former Soviet states, Asomov's jokes have not been heard on Uzbek television channels for more than a year. All the television programs featuring Asomov, including children's cartoons and animations with Asomov's voiceovers, are no longer broadcast. Asomov says he no longer receives invitations to perform in shows in Uzbekistan and says the media ignores him altogether. The comedian says no reason has been given for his apparent ban, but that it has been made clear to him that an order has been handed down.
I have contacted the media, including tabloids here, 100 times. I beg them to give me a chance to tell everybody. Obid is alive and, well, he wasn't arrested, he hasn't died. But they tell me it's not allowed. It's not allowed to mention your name. So, for over a year, I have not appeared in any Uzbek television channel, I'm not allowed to talk on the radio, and even newspapers can't mention my name.
The way Asomov found out about the ban is like life imitating comedy. After his favorite pet, an exotic parrot, disappeared, he attempted to place advertisements in local newspapers to help him find the colorful bird. One after another, however, the newspapers turned him down. He was told in confidence that they had an instruction not to publish anything about Asomov, not even about his missing parrot. Asomov can only guess that his blacklisting has something to do with his role in the popular Russian satire Krivoye Zerkala, Distorted Mirror. The pin-sized actor has won many admirers through his depiction of a host of comedic characters, including an Uzbek illegal migrant with a distinct Central Asian accent, a musician with an outrageous voice, and a misleading Russian-speaking tour guide in Venice with no knowledge of the city. Asomov suspects his portrayal of Uzbek migrant laborers in Russia and their plight is not the type of image Uzbek officials would want to see broadcast to foreign audiences.
In our country, people don't explain such reasons. I must have done something wrong, something like not attending some high-ranking official's wedding. I don't know. Or perhaps someone here didn't like my performance in Russia. Our former culture minister Anvar Jabborov once told me, "You should stop performing on Russian television." I was bemused. He told me to give him a written pledge. I refused and told him it wasn't up to me anymore. I told him even if I stopped performing, Russian television would continue to broadcast previously recorded shows.
Asomov says the most popular shows, comical or otherwise, are usually those which reflect real life and real people with everyday issues and problems. Widespread unemployment and poverty in Uzbekistan is not something that can be ignored. It has forced an estimated 8 million people to leave the country for seasonal jobs abroad. Most go to Russia, where they can find low-paid jobs at private construction sites, but live with hardship and without social protection. This, however, is not a popular topic for Uzbek television channels or the state media, which largely portray Uzbekistan as a prosperous and successful nation. Asomov is far from alone when it comes to performers being banned from Uzbek television for reasons known only to the authorities. Yulduz Usmanova, arguably the most famous Uzbek singer, reportedly fell out of favor for touring Turkmenistan without prior approval. In 2008, Usmanova left the country to live in Turkey, citing political persecution in Uzbekistan. Prominent folk singer Sherali Jurayev has long been barred from state television and radio amid rumors that authorities question his loyalty to the government. Firgana.ru, a regional news website, last year quoted an unnamed Uzbek singer as saying, "Authorities demand that at least 30% of performers' repertoire consist of patriotic songs." As for Asomov, he insists he's not interested in politics and does not publicly make political comments. The 47-year-old comedian, who has begun his acting career in Uzbekistan in 1980s, still lives in his native Tashkent along with his wife and their four children. He frequently visits Russia to record for Krivoye Zerkala and also travels abroad to perform before Russian-speaking audiences in Germany and Israel, among other places. In Uzbekistan, however, nowadays his career is limited to performing at weddings far from the capital.
And that's all we have for this week. I'm Bruce Jacobs. Thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.